Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 71 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. Today we're wrapping up our episodes with the presenters for the 2018 NSCA Training for Hockey Clinic in Colorado Springs. That's coming up later this week on June 8th and 9th. So if you haven't punched your ticket yet, if you don't have a flight out, that's okay. Check out the live stream. Just head to the NSCA's website and find the Training for Hockey Clinic. And all the information is right there for you. Today we're going to be talking to Kevin Neal. Kevin is a strength and conditioning coach with the San Jose Sharks organization. Works with Mike Potenza there. And today he's going to be talking to us about his presentation for the Training for Hockey Clinic. And that is using data to drive program design. So Kevin's going to be talking about how they use information from their movement screens and also some other topics like how the NHL is different from the private sector and the things that he learned that were really beneficial for him in the private sector. So really a great interview. This is a bit of a long one, but we'd expect nothing else from Kevin. He's a thorough guy, and I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. So really quickly, if you haven't been to HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com lately, head over and check it out. We've got a couple new videos from Devin McConnell, also an incoming freshman program from Devin McConnell for UMass Lowell. We've also got several new podcast episodes up. If you haven't kept up, we are going through all the presentations with the speakers for the NSCA clinic. So today we've wrapped that up, but still lots of great information on the site. If you're not a member, you can join us for just a buck for the first 7 days. After that, it's $14.95 a month, or you can join us for the year for just $149, and you get 2 months free with that annual membership. All right, we're looking forward to our phone conversation with Kevin Neal with the San Jose Sharks. Let's get to it. Okay, with us on the phone right now, we've got Kevin Neal. Kevin is a strength and conditioning coach in the San Jose Sharks organization. We're super excited to have him. I know every time he presents, I get a lot out of it. He's a super smart guy. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. So how's life in the NHL treating you? I know this is relatively new. You know, you're out of the private sector now and working in the NHL. Talk about your role with the Sharks and how things are going there.
Yeah, so we just wrapped up. I just wrapped up my second year here, and it 2 years in, I'm appreciating the fact that every season's a little bit different. You know, every month really is a little bit different. I think the schedule on a week to week basis presents some unique challenges, and you know, as you kind of go through that process and you know handle some of the injury cases that we've had over the last 2 years, it's just been fun. It's been a different challenge on a regular basis, which is kind of what I was looking for. And, you know, I'm fortunate to work with Mike Potenza, who's an unbelievable coworker and mentor and friend, and with a great organization that gives our department a lot of support. So it's been great.
Absolutely. So I imagine, you know, just based on what other NHL guys have said, that the challenges are very different from, you know, you're coming from the private sector. The challenges are very different. I mean, a lot of times in a private setting, correct me if I'm wrong, you probably get to do a lot more training because you have a full off season with guys and you, can really sort of get after it. You're still addressing some of the same issues, but I feel like, you know, you're sort of at the mercy of the game schedule when you're in the NHL. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And there's a lot of differences. You know, in the private sector, the typical age of the clients coming in on a year-round basis is younger than what we deal with here. I think the workloads, even though it's certainly not to undermine the stresses associated with going to school all day, and, you know, I think I've talked in the past about the problems with the youth sports landscape and how overworked kids are in that capacity, but they're still not traveling like the Pacific teams are in the NHL. And, you know, they don't have as many distractions as far as media appearances. And, you know, a lot of these guys have families and kids. And, you know, the big difference is that when you work in the private sector, the athletes are coming there to see you. They're paying their money and they're investing their time to put in some work under your expertise. And that's the whole reason that they're there. And for that component of their lives. That you're the show. You're the most, the meaning the training program is the most important part of why they're there. And in this setting, training certainly an important piece of what we do and how our team stays prepared to compete on a regular basis. But at the end of the day, the game is the most important part. So everything is catered around making sure that the players have everything they need to be prepared to compete in that game, opposed to necessarily, you know, having the training be the primary focus and other things are kind of falling around that.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. And you had mentioned something earlier on about how being in the private, in a private facility kind of made you rethink how you train teams or, you know, your approach with teams. We'll get to that a little bit. I think, you know, your presentation for the clinic, coming up here soon is performance profiling as a platform for program design. And so, you know, I think this is, well, I mean, I'll let you explain it obviously, but this is kind of using performance profiling or using individual screens to sort of dictate what you're going to be doing with players. So talk a little bit about what the approach is here and sort of the 30,000 foot view of the presentation.
Yeah, I think the general overview of the talk is what do you do? What type of tests should you do with your athletes? And then what should you do with that information? So, you know, I've talked to some of the, you know, one of the benefits of being in the private sector is that you have these athletes that come home from colleges spread out from all over the country and they're involved in all these different programs. And, you know, it's the same. I heard similar things from them that I heard from some high school athletes, from people going to combines and other testing type camps, and even some people at the pro level in different sports where they'd go through this testing battery. And when you ask if they got feedback or if that information was, if they were told how that information would be used, more often than not, the answer was no. So, you know, I think the big purpose of this talk is to just help clarify some of the ways that we have used testing to individualize our training program process. And then also how we've used it to better communicate with players and coaches to make sure that we're on the right track with what we're attempting to do from a training standpoint. And, you know, ultimately I think the more open the lines of communication are between everybody invested in that player's success and the team's success, the better the buy-in's going to be in the program. So that's kind of the 3,000 foot view of the talk.
Yeah. And that's a theme that we've seen a lot of is that, you know, helping the players understand how this is going to help them is a huge tool. You know, I know Devin McConnell and Justin Rothlingshofer talk about that a lot, where this is a tool where you can really connect some dots for guys and create buy-in by showing them that you're interested in them and their best performance. So without getting into, you know, the exact screening techniques, I guess, let's talk about sort of the value of movement screening. Are you doing this? Is this something you do daily, weekly? How do you approach your screening with the players?
Well, every case is a little bit different, but what I've tried to do for the last 7 years now, in every setting that I've been in, is when somebody comes to me for the first time, whether it's a brand new athlete or client, or whether it's somebody that I've had in the past but haven't seen in a while, I try to do an intake movement screen with them. And, you know, I think that movement screening is gotten a bad rep for a couple reasons. First, I think early on people said, well, you know, if you don't have this score, then you shouldn't do anything except corrective exercise, which is obviously crazy. And then it was, well, if you have these types of scores, then you're definitely going to get hurt, which is also kind of crazy. But just because those thought processes may be a little misguided, it doesn't mean that any form of movement screening is doesn't hold value. And, you know, for me, there's two major reasons why I think that doing some sort of movement screening, range of motion screening, movement quality screening, whatever you want to call it, is important. And the first is to see if the player has the capacity to get into optimal positions required from the sport. So, Brian, you played, and I think most of the people listening to this are at least familiar with hockey enough to understand that you know, to get into a quality skating position, it's going to require some degree of hip flexion. It's going to require some degree of ankle dorsiflexion. When you actually push out to the side, you're going to need some hip abduction and hip external rotation. And if you don't have those things, it's going to force you to adopt. If you don't have any of those things, it's going to force you to adopt a taller skating position, which ultimately is going to decrease your stride length, which is going to steal some power out of every stride that you take. So gaining a better understanding of the range of motion available to the player, and then putting that within the context, which I know we'll talk about in a few minutes here, of how they actually skate, then, you know, that kind of gives you a diagnostic tool to say, you know, if there's any red flags in that process, if, you know, somebody has really limited hip abduction, which we see surprisingly frequently with hockey players, then if we can improve that through whatever tools you have available to you, then it's likely going to have a meaningful impact on how they skate on the ice. So that's kind of the first one. And there's other examples. You know, you obviously need hip adduction and internal rotation anytime you cross over so you can get a good push under with that inside leg. You need good T-spine rotation so that you can you know, not only counterbalance the hip rotation while you're skating, but it also helps you open up to receive passes that are behind you. It helps with the shooting motion. There's a bunch of reasons why that would come into play. And then cervical rotation is another one that kind of gets overlooked. But if you keep your eyes fixed on a target like the net, and then your torso is rotating around that, your neck is actually rotating relative to your torso. So there's all sorts of different movement screens that will help you identify red flags that may come into play for the player on the ice. But then the other one, and if you're purely a strength and conditioning coach and you don't have access to the players on the ice, you don't get to see them on the ice as often as some other people do, then this may be more in your wheelhouse. But the other big one is to see if they have the capacity to get into the optimal positions required by the exercises within a program. And, you know, just as a couple examples here, you know, if you don't have shoulder internal rotation, then during the high pull of a hang clean, that bar is going to drift away from your body. And I think that that's something that you see pretty frequently in team sport athletes when you're trying to teach that lift, is that as they go through that second pull or that high pull motion, the bar drifts out away from them. And then when they try to catch it, they either clip their chin or it slams on their shoulders, or, you know, it's just not as smooth and clean, not able to move as much weight and generate as much power as you would want. So that very well could be a technique thing, but that technique thing may be stemming from a limitation in shoulder internal rotation. And until that's cleared up, the coach is going to be beating their head against a wall trying to get this athlete to adopt a pattern that they don't have the capacity to perform. And then the other side of that, and this is one that I think gets overlooked quite a bit, is that you need shoulder external rotation to get into a good catch position. So, you know, if you're sitting down right now and you put your arm straight out in front of your shoulder, and then you externally rotate your hand as far as you can, and then you bend your elbow to try to get into try to bend your elbow to full flexion, you're going to see, and then you're going to have to obviously pronate your wrist, but you need that external rotation in order to get your hand outside your shoulder to get into a catch position. If you don't have that external rotation, you're going to have to torque on your wrist more to put your hand where it needs to be to hold the bar. So, you know, I think that those are two, just with one variation of an Olympic lift, that kind of highlight that, you know, some of the common technique flaws that we see or pain complaints that we hear as far as wrist issues in the catch position may be stemming from some sort of range of motion limitation that we're just not looking for. And then another one is, if you don't have ankle dorsiflexion, or if you have some sort of ankle dorsiflexion limitation, when you go to descend into a squat position, if your knees can't come forward as much as they should, your hips are going to have to go back further than they would be in an optimal position. And to keep the bar centered over the midfoot, the torso is going to have to lean forward more. So, you know, what that translates to is that you're squatting from more of a deadlifting position than you would a true squat position, which, you know, with the bar on your back, it's going to put a little more shearing force on the low back. And, you know, you're a little bit more likely to hit end range hip flexion at a higher squatting position than you would want. So, you know, those are just a couple examples that movement screening can be valuable from an on-ice performance standpoint, but it can also be really valuable in pre-qualifying athletes for different exercises within a training program. So, you know, and will those things translate into or have some relationship with injury risk? I think so, but there's a lot of other factors that come into play there as far as, you know, if somebody doesn't have hip range of motion and they adopt a higher skating position, they might be okay if they stay in that higher skating position. But if somebody keeps cueing them to get lower and lower and lower, then they might be more likely to push through a range of motion that they don't have the capacity to reach, right? So the amount of time that they spend in a provocative or potentially dangerous position may dictate whether they end up having some sort of symptom as a result of that or not.
Yeah, and that's something you've talked a lot about in the past. I think we've actually had a podcast episode on that FAI and, you know, what exacerbates that and how a lot of players are asymptomatic because, well, most likely they're avoiding it, avoiding the pain in their skating stride. But yeah, I like how you take these at an individual level and just kind of look and see, where is this player limited? Is this good enough? Are they performing fine at this level? You know, I think we've talked about that before too, where there is sort of good enough. You know, they maybe have like an unconventional skating style or an unconventional squat style, but it's effective for them. Is that, do you draw hard lines there, or is it, like you said, on a case by case basis?
I think you try to look at everything on a case by case basis. And I try to approach the training process as identifying the largest barriers for a player being successful in whatever role they're being asked to perform. So, you know, if a player skates high, but their speed is one of their more advantageous qualities, then, you know, that might be something that I'm still aware of and still comes into play from a training standpoint. But if they're a player that has difficulty sustaining that type of speed and power from shift to shift, then, you know, we might be looking at a different energy system quality as the primary point of attack and, you know, just kind of addressing some of those, whatever range of motion barriers we find in the background. But, you know, the other side of that is if you get a player that skates too high because they lack ankle range of motion, and then the feedback on them from them or from coaches is that they're having a hard time keeping up with the play, then yeah, that might be the first thing that we go after to try to clear that up. And then, you know, also obviously look at what some of their speed and power testing scores are too. So that's kind of it for me, Brian. It's looking at, you know, what's the largest barrier for this player being successful? And then does our screening process raise any red flags that would speak to that we can address and use as a point of feedback as we continue to try to make progress?
Well, yeah, that's perfect. I mean, you talk about the feedback. This is feedback that you give the players, you know, is that how you tend to operate? You know, you find something and you talk to the player about it?
Sure. I mean, I like I alluded to earlier, I think anytime you collect data from a player, they should have full access to everything that you're collecting. And they should also know how that information is being used to help them. And, you know, we kind of mentioned earlier that engaging the player in that conversation is going to help with their buy-in. But more importantly, from a coaching standpoint, it also gives you another point of contact to help validate what you're seeing or question what you're seeing. And, you know, step one is making sure that you have the right test to be able to identify some sort of meaningful limitations or points of strength for a player based on what their sport demands are, right? But then step two is everything should start with that player's performance on the ice, and then you should work backwards to use your testing as a diagnostic tool. And, you know, there's been a couple research studies that have assessed the relationship between vertical jumps and vertical jump height and running speed and vertical jump height and on ice sprinting speed, and then even off ice sprinting speed and on ice sprinting speed. And those relationships across the board tend to be pretty moderate, meaning there's some overlap in how those qualities translate to those different patterns, but it's not like 100% the person with the highest vertical jump is also going to be the fastest runner or also going to be the fastest skater. So keeping that in mind, you have to appreciate the fact that, one, any test that you do also has some level of a skill component. So jumping is a skill, sprinting is a skill, skating is a skill. And if somebody's particularly gifted in the movement quality of any one of those tests, it's going to influence the relationship and how that translates to the other, right? So, but all of that to say that if you see somebody whose off-ice power numbers don't look good, automatically from a coaching standpoint, you're thinking that if I make this better, then, you know, they're probably not as fast on the ice as they could be. And if I make this better, they're going to be faster. But if you get feedback from the coach or from the player that their speed is great, it's one of their strengths and it's not one of their limiting factors, then you have to rethink whether that is the appropriate quality to target from an off-ice training perspective. And, you know, we, when I was at working in the private sector, and then even now here with the Sharks, we tend to build in tests that have a layer of redundancy. So, you know, one of the things I noticed working at Endeavor is that we did a vertical jump and we did a lateral bound test with an entire junior hockey team. And it was interesting to me because the best vertical jumpers weren't the best lateral bounders. Even when we put the lateral bound distance relative to their split distance and to their leg length, there still wasn't a clear direct relationship there. So automatically you have to question, you know, is power power? Can you just say, if you only do one power test, are you going to be misclassifying some of the players as underpowered when in reality it might be that if you had a different power test, they might really shine and come to the top of the group. So, you know, I think building in some layers of redundancy there is important. But then using things like the raw test score. So, you know, how is, and we'll stick with vertical jump because I think that that's one that a lot of people are familiar with, but How does that test score rank compared to historical norms within the sport? Is it, you know, towards the top of the pack? Is it in the middle? Is it more towards the bottom? And then another layer is, how does it rank relative to the current team? You know, I think you see changes over time in the emphasis on testing, and then even the size of the athlete has changed even over the last 10, 15 years. You're seeing smaller players have a better opportunity to succeed at higher levels now. So, and then the third big part is, how does that test result compare to where it was for that player in previous testing? So somebody comes and jumps at 26 inches and it's just kind of middle of the pack. But, you know, when you saw them the previous offseason, whatever the case is, last time you tested them, they jumped 22. That might be a sign that player is really trending in the right direction and making the progress that they need. So I think all of those things are important to consider in how you're using the testing to help the players. And then, you know, I think how we started on this conversation is, all of that needs to be part of a conversation that you have with the players. And then I think with the coaches too, especially if you don't have an opportunity to see the players play as much, getting feedback from about that player's style from not just the player but also from the coaches may give you a slightly different perspective on the player's game and what the team needs from them. So,
well, and I think you touched on it too. You know, we first referred to it as feedback, which a lot of times I think people assume means coach giving feedback to the player, but it's a two-way street there, and that's kind of where the most value lies, is if you can have a good relationship with your players and you're giving them feedback and they're also able to return, you know, and say, hey, this is what's feeling good. This is what I feel like I'm good at. This is where I succeed in hockey, or this is where I succeed in games. That's where you really sort of start to drill down to that, you know, like you said, on that case by case basis, what's going to help players improve the most. And then, you know, your work in a private setting, you know, you mentioned that helps you rethink team-based programs. It was that, you sort of touched on the redundancy a little bit in terms of screening. Is that the major way, or is there another way that you know, that private sector help you in a team setting?
Well, I think that's a piece of it, but really my 7 years in the private sector was an evolution all the way through the end. And, you know, when I first got there, I really thought that if I just put together a really solid program that had these standardized progressions and periodized sequencing as far as what qualities were the focus from phase to phase, that would be all I needed. And that would be, you know, really helpful for all the athletes that go through that program. And in reality, I think there's something to that. I think a well-designed program is going to help a lot of people. But, you know, I started pretty early on. I started to get some players coming in with different injuries that they were recovering from or aches and pains that they had suffered from over the years. And pretty quickly, you know, I realized that, all right, certain exercises aren't as good of a fit for people based on these pain symptoms and based on these injury histories than others. And, you know, you start to make some adjustments just based on injury history. And then, you know, I started to get more into movement screening, kind of coincident with that, just as a way, you know, if somebody has a history of groin pain, is there anything that I can pick up in a basic movement screen that might help me help this player avoid having those symptoms in the future? And, you know, kind of in the same vein, you start to realize that not everybody has the same movement capabilities. So there's going to be certain exercises that might be really great fits for certain athletes and might not be great fits for others. So early on, I think I started to appreciate that at least from an exercise selection standpoint, there needed to be some level of catering to individual needs and individual abilities. And then, you know, as time gets on, everybody, you talk to all the athletes that come in the door, you talk to all the parents that come in the door, you talk to coaches when they bring their teams in, and everybody has a specific goal that they want to work on. And, you know, kind of within the same context is, you know, if you get somebody that comes in and the primary reason they're coming to see you is because they want to improve their speed, which is one we hear a lot. And then you get somebody else that comes in and the primary thing that they want to work on is losing a little bit of weight and, you know, improving themselves aerobically. The optimal program to address those two needs aren't the same. And I think one of the questions that I started to ask myself a few years in at Endeavor, and it's one that I continue to ask myself now, is if your entire career was dependent upon your success in helping this one person, how would you approach designing the program for that person? And I couldn't look myself in the mirror and say, you know, if we have somebody whose primary goal is speed and somebody else whose primary goal is fat loss and aerobic conditioning, that they should be on the same program. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And, you know, I think that's when we really took a turn from a business model standpoint and started to get more into semi-private training models where we had these smaller groups coming in at the same time, but everybody had their own program based on their own movement needs and then their own training goals. And, you know, the final step for me, Brian, was when we started to do more intake performance-based testing. And, you know, one of the things that really jumped out to me right away is that two athletes with identical training goals might be starting in really, really different places. So, you know, you hear people want to improve speed a lot. That's probably the most common the most common training goal that we heard then. And then even now it's one that comes up a lot. But if somebody comes in and they want to improve speed and they're totally untrained, they're weak, they don't move well, they don't have a lot of training experience, I think there's still a more intelligent way to approach that training program, but that's a type of athlete that might respond to just a really well-designed kind of standardized training program that focuses on building work capacity up front and then, you know, transitions into a strength phase and then a strength power and then more of a kind of traditional speed phase towards the end, where if you get somebody that comes in and has a high training age and they're really strong, but their rate of force development's a limitation, then the way that you would approach that program should absolutely be different than the player that's untrained and has a lot of room to grow in all qualities. So, you know, I think that when you take that concept where I'm seeing individuals come in with individual goals and then individual training backgrounds in these different profiles. And then you apply that to a team setting, you're going to see similar things as far as, you know, you might have a handful of guys where speed is the major limitation in their performance on the ice or within whatever sport that they have. But then their level of physical preparation and their training background is going to be totally different from one another. So how you approach providing the right stimulus for those players to adapt and improve their speed should be different. So I think that, you know, my experience in kind of the evolution that still continues this day, obviously, but over those 7 years that I worked in the private sector, it really made me appreciate that one, there's a lot of value in identifying the baseline across the board of where that athlete's starting at from a movement perspective, which we talked about, from a performance testing standpoint, which we talked about. And then two, using that information to inform how you're going to individualize the program to better cater to their needs. So that's kind of the general gist. And, you know, that's what I'm hoping to shed some light on in the presentation in Colorado Springs in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And I think it'll be a really good compliment to Devin McConnell and Justin Rothlingshofer's presentation. They're going to be talking more day to day, but I like the idea. This is almost the, you know, providing the direction for the programming for each individual athlete. And then, you know, we talk about little micro changes with the other presentation. So it'll be a great compliment. And, you know, just like I feel like every other year, there's such a great collection of topics and presentations, and things always mesh well together out there. So it's a great, great opportunity to learn from some really smart people and looking forward to that and looking forward to hearing from you. Now, last question here, are you going to be all presentation or are you hands-on as well?
Yeah. So I think I'm going to be all presentation, but Scott and I talked about this type of topic. I don't think really lends itself well to, you know, get out on the training floor and do some hands-on work. But I do think it lends itself well to conversations about program design. So we had talked about, you know, as soon as I finish, I think the next thing up on the schedule is a roundtable discussion. So, you know, depending on whether I think I have an hour and 20 minute time slot, but whether I use all that time or not, we will just transition into a roundtable. And my understanding is that we're going to use at least a portion of that time to dive a little bit deeper into program design. And, you know, hopefully the coaches in the audience ask some questions about how some of the concepts that all the presenters talked about that day can be meaningful for their programs. And we can kind of troubleshoot some different situations and, you know, hopefully have a good conversation.
Right on. Yeah. I think that's a great way to approach it. Although knowing you, the way that I do here, I think you probably have no problem filling that hour and 20 minutes, but we'll see how it goes out there. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's been an issue. I usually fill the hour when I have an hour. So
yeah. But hey, Kevin, thank you so much for your time today, and I'm looking forward to your presentation. And we'll see you out in Colorado Springs.
Great, thanks for having me, Brian. Looking forward to seeing everybody in a couple weeks.
All right, that's going to wrap up episode 71 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. We hope to see you out in Colorado Springs, and we'll get back to our regular programming after the weekend here. But we are looking forward to meeting all these guys out in Colorado Springs and having a good time and hopefully learning and connecting and all the things that clinics are great for. So we'll see you out in Colorado Springs, guys. Until then, be sure to train smart and check out HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, the world's greatest resource for training hockey players. Talk to you soon.